On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm just saying this for the history record. Then I ran into Spike at the governor's ball. I stuck out my hand to shake his hand. And I started to say, I know you're probably, you know, I probably got three words out. I was going to say, like, about these are just my thoughts. This is, you know, how much I respect you and all that kind of stuff. And he did shake my hand, but he let go of it and kept walking. And as he walked, he turned around and said, you know, because I had made a tweet. Which just lets me know he was reading my tweets, so it made me kind of feel good. I made a tweet during the thing of saying, you know, like, it was good to have a film out at the same time as Spike. It was like a dream, like, in the theaters at the same time, you know. And I said that was like Miles and Dizzy or whatever going back and forth. And they, you know, and there's something that feels like that. Anyway, so he was like, you made a tweet saying something about Miles and Dizzy. I want to tell you something. And he's backing up as he's saying this, and then he yells out, I'm Miles Davis, you're Chet Baker.
Boots Riley is the director of Sorry to Bother You, one of last year's best films and the most anti-capitalist film to ever come out of Hollywood, and a debut film of such intelligence and originality that it announces an important new filmmaking voice. I can't wait to see what he does next. I've been a fan of Boots's for a long time. His rap group The Coup was awesome. Imagine De La Soul with Bay Area activist politics. And they were the first group I ever wrote about for The Village Voice back at the beginning of my media career, like 25 or more years ago. That was The Coup's first review, so I guess we've grown up together in a way. Boots is someone I've wanted to have on this show for a long time, so I'm thrilled to finally get to do this. And stay tuned to the end, or skip ahead if you have to, when Boots talks about his critique of Spike Lee's Black Klansman. It's Boots Riley on Touré Show.
For my money, in my book, Sorry to Bother You was the best film I saw last year. Because it was smart, it was challenging, it was funny, it was so engrossing, it brought in so many issues and so many thoughts, and it was so real, it was fantastical and yet real at the same time. And I was just so entranced. Take me back to the beginning, because, you know, I knew you first as a rapper in The Coup.
Yeah, matter of fact, you were our first ever review that we got.
Well, that was the first review that I wrote back in the Village Voice.
And it's funny because I remember you caught something that a lot of people didn't catch and that I was actually mad about, because you caught the De La Soul influence.
Mm.
And what was interesting for us in the West Coast, when people said backpack rap, we had a different feeling behind it, because for many people, I will say on the West Coast, their connection to native tongue experience, of which I'm obviously a fan, as you even pointed out in that first interview, a giant fan. But a lot of the connection was, well, at least this isn't here, right? At least this isn't my neighborhood.
Right.
Like, it was like this fantasy world that was without racism, without being stereotyped as this, you know, as a thug or whatever. And so we saw that, like, we saw people all of a sudden talking with New York accents and stuff like that.
Okay.
That had never been there. And and, you know, for me, because I was already involved in organizing, I didn't, you know, many people took it as like, oh, fuck them backpackers, you know.
Right.
because they felt like, oh, they were shunning. They were like being somebody that they weren't. But I understood it as like people kind of feeling powerless to change their situation. So they figure out, how can I go to something else?
Right.
You know, how can I? And but either way, I didn't want to do that. But you can't like hide your influences.
Right.
That, you know, so right. Yeah, you know.
Right. No, right, right. I mean, somebody like De La Soul comes along. I mean, it changed it for a lot of people. You know, I mean, I thought it was just me. Because I think about, I loved hip hop from the first time I heard Rapper's Delight. But when I heard De La, I realized that I had loved it, but I had not felt like this is me, right? Like those guys are me more than the singers.
Mm.
But when I heard De La, I was like, oh, that's who I would be if I was a rapper. And they brought me into the culture, made me feel more embraced by the culture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, Questlove has said the same thing. There's been some other people who said the same thing. But I'm excited to see you make a big move to being a director. What was the beginning of you saying, well, I want to do that. I want to make films.
I think the beginning of me seriously saying it was when it must have been Do the Right Thing. You know?
Really?
Yeah, because I was, so my grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater in the 70s and 80s. And I was involved, you know, the first time I rapped was because I was writing the school play.
Okay.
And, well, no, I rapped, you know, around, but it was like I was actually stealing Schooly D's raps because nobody knew them over there. So that didn't count. I was, you know, just banging on the tables saying Schooly D raps, and people were like, oh, that's cool.
He's amazing. You know? Yeah. You're amazing.
And but we had to, they wanted to do a version of West Side Story. And so I wrote it for the school, and it was with raps, and people didn't boo. And then I was involved in the Black Repertory Theater, which was like a storefront theater that like, we would do our own stuff, but then they'd have it like Roger Guinevere Smith was constantly there doing the same play he's doing now, which is Frederick Douglass.
Yes.
And, you know, so I see all of that. And so, and because I had been involved in, or by this time as a teenager, I'd been involved in organizing farm workers in the Central California Valley. There was this story of Teatro Campesino, which was, had been around in the 60s and part of the Cesar Chavez movement, in which they would do plays for people as they were coming out of the fields that encouraged them to join the union and
okay. Things
like that. And so, like, I had this idea of political theater.
Okay.
And but then I started kind of getting frustrated that, okay, Black Repertory Theater was like, we could fit 40 people in there at the most.
Sure.
And I was like, fuck, that's a lot of plays you got to do to get to the world. And Do the Right Thing came out. And I was like, okay, I want to do this. Well, at the same time, obviously, you know, at the same time, you know, I've been doing music, and Oakland was the place, became the place that every record label had to have somebody from,
right,
because of Digital Underground, because of MC Hammer,
Too
because
Short.
Of Too Short, you know, and our first producer was actually Too Short's DJ. And anyway, so I went to college. I went to school for film at San Francisco State.
Okay.
And that was my idea. But at the same time as I was realizing it back then, I got into school in late 89, and, you know, things were going to cost a lot of money back then, even for short films. Like, and I was paying that scene in the movie where Cassius says 40 on 2. Like, I actually was doing that to get to school. What, mind you, this is 1990, so 40 cents could actually get you a little bit further. But it was still enough to where my plan was, I spend 25 to 40 cents to make sure I didn't run out of gas on the bridge to get to San Francisco State. And when I was there, asking people for a loan. Like, I would be at school asking people for money to get home.
Can I get a dollar?
You know, yeah.
Can I get a dollar?
Well, dollar was a lot, but.
Can I get 50 cents?
Yeah. Yeah, like, just to put in the gas tank. Oh, you need a ride? You know, that's something like that. And so, but we made this EP that, you know, because I used my my knowledge of blanketing an area from doing political work, we, like, everybody was like, I don't know who the fuck the coup is, but I see their poster everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I need, what is this? You know, and so at one point we became the most selling tape at the local record stores.
Okay.
And that just happened to be the week of the Gavin Convention, which was like the radio thing. And so
right.
Wild Pitch Records came, blah, blah, blah. They gave us a call, and I was in school. I was like, okay, you know, maybe this is what I'm doing instead of film. So I've been talking about doing film
you
for
were on
a long
the film track before you were signed as an MC.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. And which is why, like, we got known for a lot of, like, 8-minute long songs that tell a story, and then, or sometimes tell a story and then they weave in with three other songs, because I was looking for ways to kind of make film with music, you
okay.
know?
Okay.
Like, we even would have, like, one long skit about sneaking into stuff and all that kind of stuff and get into the sound design. And so I felt like, whoa, I can kind of sneak and make a movie
okay.
With these things. So, but I didn't think that, I didn't see the future as film becoming cheaper, things like that. And also, I think I was fine with the reach I was having with the music and the connection that I was having to different social movements and stuff like that. But after a while, the artist in me just kind of needed something to mix it up. You know, I had done some other stuff. I had done Street Sweeper Social Club with Tom Morello.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was an experience that made me, for the first time, not feel as satisfied, because, you know, it was a situation in which, like, Tom was like, I want everybody to know your work, so I want you to, let's do this, and which was great of him, because it did
sure
expand people knowing my work. But it was also his music and my lyrics just kind of mechanically put on top. I think with our second release, it became less mechanical. But it was not as satisfying for me coming out of the coup, where the coup is like, here's my vision.
Right.
Let's right. make this happen. And I assembled the group of folks that helped make this vision happen, which was a lot more satisfying.
Sure.
And so I started not feeling that satisfied with this, and started kind of looking at, you know, my life and being like, okay, well, what are the things that I want to do? And knowing that what I've learned over all this time is that the main ingredient you have to have is passion. Not this sort of sense of, like, I see people faltering when they're, like, even in the creation process of music, where they're like, okay, this is the thing that worked, so therefore I need to do that thing that worked again, you know, because, and you subtract yourself from what you want to do based on what you think you're supposed to do,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, you know, that's when it starts fizzling, because people sense that there's not passion there. And that's what we're all wanting. We're all wanting engagement with life. We want art that makes us feel engaged with the world. And for that to happen, that artist has to have a passion.
I mean, you clearly have a lot of passion. And just listening to you, I keep hearing the art comes out of political desires, right? You talk about the theater and, I mean, what the coup was all about and what this film is all about. You don't want to just perform or just entertain. It seems like you start as a political thinker and then layer the art on top of that. Is that how you think
of it? I mean, I think that's how everyone, you start as who you are, right? As what you think about, what you care about. You know, I mean, Cypress Hill, they cared about smoking weed. That's what they were really passionate
about.
And
you're from a family of organizers and activists, and the Bay is very thoughtful and intellectual and activist. And
yeah, I mean, you know, and there's complications to all of that. Like, by the time I started getting involved in radical politics, my parents had been burnt out of that scene already, and they, you know, were doing their thing. Extensions of what they thought they were already doing. So my father became a public defender and a criminal defense attorney, which he felt was an extension of the radical politic that he was doing. Matter of fact, growing up as a teenager in Oakland, I might sneak into a bar and then somebody would be like, "Nobody fucks with him. All his drinks are on me." And be like, "Your daddy got me off. You know, like, wow. I was going to be in jail for 20 years. And, you know, he came, you know, got me off."
The film had been written several years before it got produced. Talk about conceiving and creating this as a script.
Yeah, okay. So in between Genocide and Juice and Steal, this album, Genocide and Juice, we had this this song, Fat Cats and Bigger Fish, which was getting played on the radio in L.A. by just a you know, quirk of fate. And anyway, what happened with that left to me, you know, the EMI told the radio stations to stop playing it. And so that left me feeling like, okay, I was 24, I spent all my life doing music and being this artist with this idea of connecting my stuff to a movement. Then I was like, fuck, I have no control over anything. And I stopped doing music, and we created this organization called the Young Comrades. And in order to do that, I needed to get a job. So I got a job doing telemarketing because I was good. You know, the other side of me is that I've also been doing sales since I was 11, like the kid knocking on your door and giving you the sob story about, you know, the last paper before so you can go to Disneyland and you've never been out of town before, you know, that sort of thing. And so I knew I was good at that, and I could work there one day every 2 weeks and pay my rent.
Okay.
And so I did that. And from that, and I eventually went back to Young Comrades, folded, and I went back and made Steal This Album, which a lot of the musicians were people in the Young Comrades, so a lot of stuff like that. But so I always had these stories, and I knew that I wanted to make a film at some point, and so I just kind of downloaded Final Draft one day and started writing. And the idea was, I knew that I wanted it to take place in the world of telemarketing.
Okay.
And because it was ripe with stories. Matter of fact, 95% of the stories didn't make it into the film, because as I started writing, I realized this is not really a film about telemarketing.
I knew
one thing. I knew there was going to be an on-the-job struggle, which the main character had to decide which side he was going to be on. And I knew the opening scene, because that had been how my boy Rob Ebo got all of his jobs. He never got caught.
By lying about...
Yeah, by actually printing up, like, Employee of the Month awards and stuff like that, and bringing them with him. And
that's amazing.
And having fake phone numbers of, you know, or telling somebody who is the busboy at this restaurant, saying that that's the manager, and, you know.
Don't try this at home.
And it would always work. And then I knew the compliment argument, because that happened to my little brother years ago, and I was always like, I'm putting that in a movie. I don't care, you know.
Right, where I hope you have a good day. I hope you have a good, right? That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
And that scene was crazy, because I had only written five back and forths, which is kind of like what had happened to my brother. And it seemed funny on the page, but I knew it was going to be hard, because, you know, like, if you're, you, for me, the comedy where you know they're trying to make you laugh, that doesn't work. That doesn't work for me.
Sure.
And so, and we had two different kinds of actors because Jermaine
Fowler
is a comedian.
Right.
And so he's trying to make you laugh, you know, in the rest of his life.
Right.
Right. And also, for an actor, you could read the thing and be like, oh, this is funny.
Right.
And that's the way you play it. So as they were rehearsing, we didn't really have time for rehearsals before. So we did one read through and it was like with the zing, gotcha. And I was like, okay, I don't know. And then we and tried to shape that. But again, with doing this, as we're going, I'm learning my language for speaking to actors.
Okay.
You know, luckily I had had the Sundance Director's Lab. And figured some of that out. We had some great advisors and understood some of that. But some things you just get into right then and have to figure out. And so they're rehearsing, they're rehearsing their thing like as we're shooting this other scene. And it's funny because Danny was there sitting at a table as they're rehearsing, and he was like, "I don't know if he meant this, but he was like, well, sounds like, yeah, Danny Glover. He was like, well." Like he was just commenting because I was looking at them. They were standing there doing it, and he looked at me and said, "Well, sounds like a comedy act or whatever." But he said it as a compliment.
Okay.
But I read something else in there too, and you know, and I was like, "Okay, we're trying to get it going." And I was trying to figure out what it was. Was it inflections? Was it this or that? And it just what. Wasn't work, and I was thinking, oh, we might just have to cut this scene out, you know. And then we started filming it because meanwhile, while they're rehearsing it, I'm going back and forth, you know, as we're changing the lights on a different scene and coming back and checking on them. And so then we start filming it, and it's still like this comedy way. And then I finally figured it out. I don't know exactly what I said, but it was something about, you know, like just I mean, it's simple, like you, like, look. You want to kill each other, but you don't want to get caught, you know?
But you do love each other, even though you're angry as hell at each
other. Yeah, but that was the key to it. But the point is, though, that by the time we figured that out, we'd already spent too much time on the scene. And then by the time they figured that out, then I realized, whoa, this is way more hilarious than I thought it was going to be. This... five back and forth, that's not enough. Like, so then I was like, just keep going. This is why we end up having to have the camera just behind Jermaine for the whole time, because by the time they got it, we were like, my AD was like, we gotta go. We're sacrificing all this other stuff. And so that, you know, a lot of it was just gotten on the last like two takes, and we had to use the second camera to shoot a different thing while we were shooting over Jermaine's shoulder. So that's why we stay there for that whole time, because
there's so much black art that talks about the white voice in a reductive way, right? Mm-hmm. So much of Comic View and so many comedians, they just go into the nasal thing and mm-hmm. make fun of the sound. And you take into account that, right? And Dan Glover's like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. And when you take it to that deeper level of like, no, like you have entitlement. Like, you know you're going to have a job. Yeah. Like, that blew my mind, because that's a much deeper sense of what the white voice is communicating. So much of the movie is about dealing with the white voice.
Yeah.
I mean, that and the way you use that idea was really powerful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the idea is that it is just that. It's an idea that all of these things, that we're all doing performances at some level, and we can't get away from that. But the question is why and what we're getting out of it, and some of these performances are not necessarily conscious like it is in the movie, but the idea that even for white people, it's a performance.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colin McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
Get back to Boots Riley in 1 second, but I want to give a shout out to longtime supporter of the show, Saks Underwear, who knows guys deserve great underwear. They sent me all these great pairs. They look really cool. There's all sorts of whimsical designs. They sent me these swim trunks that are really awesome too. And the thing is, you put them on, they fit comfortably, they're thin, they're smooth, they keep you in place, and you forget about it. And that's what you want from your underwear. Forget about it. I don't want to have to think about it. It doesn't ride up. It just holds me in place, and everything is cool all day long. It's the underwear that you deserve. So order a few pairs of Saks underwear. That's SAXX underwear.com, Saks with two X's. Use the promo code Torre at checkout. SaksUnderwear.com, promo code Torre. Look, it's cool underwear that's thin, that's breathable, it feels good. It's probably the best underwear you could possibly get, unless you're like a billionaire and you have like billionaire underwear, which I don't even know what that would be. But Saks underwear is underwear that the regular guy can love.
You chose two of the greatest, smartest young actors to be your leads in Lakeith Stanfield and Tessa Thompson, both people who I would watch do anything on their own, and to see them together is extraordinary. Why them, and how'd you get them?
So, let's see. So, originally, you know, the whole way I got this film made was kind of a stone soup sort of a thing. Well, this person's on board. You should read this. You know, it's hard to get my screenplay read in the first place, because who wants to read the screenplay of a rapper? Very few people. And so, you know, the first people to get on board were David Cross and Patton Oswalt. That didn't get money people interested, but it made people think maybe it's funny, you know.
Right.
And then Dave Eggers published it as its own paperback book in 2014.
McSweeney's.
Yeah. And on McSweeney's as part of the whatever, the quarterly. And that went out to like 20,000 people. So that got me like wind in my sails. And then, Sundance. So at a certain point, after I had gone to the Sundance Writers Lab, but before I had gone to the Directors Lab, a friend of mine was like, I just went to, a friend of mine was like, I just went to wedding and Jordan Peele was there. So, I got the, and I don't know, my brain is just not working right now, so I'm not giving this person credit where it's due. So I'm not even going to remember his name on purpose now, because it's going to be like a diss if I finally remember his name now. But anyway, Jordan Peele had gone to his wedding. Okay. And I was like, dude, get this script to Jordan Peele. And he got it to him. And like a couple days later, Jordan Peele hit me up saying, okay, I want to play the lead in this. Right.
Whoa.
So, then months went by, blah blah blah, this and that, and he did a reading for us in a Sundance reading.
Wow.
And then he directed Get Out.
And, changed everything.
Yeah, and he was like, Get Out hadn't come out yet, but he was like, I don't want to act anymore, you know. And then he was like, but you know, I'll help you get to whoever you need to get to. And I was like, okay, Donald Glover. Then Donald Glover was like, I want to play the lead in this.
Wow.
And he said, but I might have to do this. I don't know. I might get this Star Wars part. I don't know. And and then the day that he, announced the part, right before that, he called me and told me, and then then he hung up the phone. 10 minutes after that, I get a call from Lakeith's manager.
Whoa.
Who's like, you need to talk to Lakeith. You need to talk to Lakeith. So, one, these couple folks being interested in being around it kind of made it seem like it must be a good project. It had gone through Sundance. By this time, I'd gone through the Director's Lab and all that kind of stuff, too. So, it gave it some promise. But I only knew Lakeith from Short Term 12, and there had only been like one or two episodes of Atlanta out by then, and so I wasn't sure. He kind of seemed like he might seem too young or whatever. But when I met with him, I just saw the crazy in his eyes and was like, "Okay, this is the right one." Luckily for us, in between that time, he blew up. Right.
Right.
And but even so, even before he kind of blew up, as soon as I cast him, because I was worried that, like you talk to money people and they're like, oh, this person is not popular enough, that blah blah blah, But by then, all the heat on the project was enough to where I could cast Lakeith, and people were like, okay, cool, that's fine, And I cast him, and it sent up a flare to other actors that, like, okay, this is the kind of movie that they're making.
Okay.
It's one thing to hear about this crazy screenplay in Sundance, but then to not really know what the director's vision. And I think that sent out a message to other actors, what I was trying to do. Now, I had written Tessa a letter, like, a year before. An email a year before that she never answered. And a couple weeks after I cast Lakeith, I get a response. I accept, And yeah. And by this time I had some other favorites, and I was also feeling a little bit like, you didn't answer my email for a year and all that kind of stuff.
Who's your favorite
before her? I don't know. But
smart man.
And so I would, but also maybe feeling a little bit like, you didn't answer my email for a year, whatever. And And so I was like, and I had heard that she would never do a reading or an audition. So I was like, and also I honestly felt like this is my first time and people could be great actors, but what if they don't work?
Chemistry.
We get there on the day.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I knew that that relationship had to seem
real.
Yeah, yeah. For us to get all the crazy stuff, we had to care about some real things
yeah.
in there. And, yeah, and so kind of as a thing, I was like, okay, only if she'll do a chemistry read, thinking like she's going to say no, and then I get, you know, that sort of thing. And she was like, no, I'll do one. And then we couldn't organize it, so we were all in the same place. So we did a three-way Skype with
okay.
Lakeith in L.A., me in Oakland, and her in upstate New York where she was filming something. And it was fire on the laptop screen. And I was just like, okay, this is it. You know, I also was, like, a little bit worried about certain kind of casting when somebody is too big mm-hmm. that you just see that person mm-hmm. on there. Like, you know, And I think there are certain movies that are set up in that way where it's like you don't remember who the character was, you just remember it was that actor in a movie. And I was really wanting everybody to lose themselves in it, and also, you know, the viewers and the actors. So I was a little worried about that, but when they did their chemistry test, it was obvious. And I even said to her, she was like, what's going on here? I was like, well, I'm worried that you're in everything. And she was like, Lakeith is in everything.
It's perfect. And, but when she does the performance art and they're throwing batteries at her, I mean, it's a powerful scene. I'm afraid for her. I'm proud of her as an artist, and there's just so much going on.
Yeah, it was hard to even be in there for people that were the extras, and so it was just this surreal experience, and people were like walking out like, I can't watch this. Even though, you know, these are like foam things that are being thrown at her.
Sure.
So when she's looking like that's her acting. It's not like she's not getting hurt.
Do you see the ending as tragic?
No, he's fighting in the end. He's fighting with, and in the beginning he wasn't fighting,
but he has literally lost himself. He is no longer
maybe.
A human being.
Yeah, but well, he's fighting, and about to be part of changing the world. I would think that he's found himself.
I wanted to have this discussion of this movie, even though it's like a year old, because I wanted to motivate others to go see it as well as speak to the people who've already seen it. So I'm trying to avoid the spoilers for those who have not seen it, because it's highly, highly recommended. I love this movie. I've watched it a bunch of times. But I want to talk about something that's not in the very end.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, though, for those who have not seen it yet. Why don't we get to see the big evil boss owner get stomped out and killed? Like, clearly that's going to come. But you cut to black and mm-hmm. move it. Like, and
well,
I kind of wanted to see him get his ass
yeah.
kicked, because he does racist
well,
stuff. He does, you know, anti-worker stuff. He's a bad
yeah.
guy.
Well, a few reasons. One, the fight always keeps going on. Like, I didn't want to give it something like, boom, it's all over with.
Okay.
And
okay.
problem solved. You know, it's like, you know, he might have an escape hatch, you know, and get away. Which,
and then there's other people like him. You beat him up. There's still
yeah,
others.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the other part of it is we made this movie for $3.6 million. That would have been
that's
hard
nothing.
To film. So that's a big part of it.
What did it make?
It made... Now all together made like 20 something million, you know, because we're, you know, I think it made close to 20 here in the U.S. And then we released it like 6 months later in the U.K. and France and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And then it also Hulu and all that kind of stuff. So
you made a $20 million, $20+ million grosser for under $4 million, which is change in Hollywood. So does that mean that you can go to any studio and be like, this is what I want to make, and everybody is taking your calls and listening to you now?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they have to be good ideas. And sure. I'm writing three things right now.
What's next?
Let's see. So I have a feature deal with Annapurna. It's kind of basically like whatever I want to do. I'm writing that.
Give me the elevator pitch for the next film.
Nope. And I'm doing a TV show with Michael Ellenberg's company, Media Res. Michael Ellenberg used to run HBO and now has his own studio. So I just wrote the pilot for that. And then I'm writing a standalone episode for Guillermo del Toro's Netflix horror anthology. The anthology is called 10 After Midnight. So, yeah, that's almost done, too.
So with one behind you, as a director, what would you do differently next time?
Well, here's the thing. Had I ever made a film, I probably wouldn't have made that film.
Why?
Because, okay, we, like I said, we did that for $3.6 million, which meant part of how we did that is we did 61 locations in 28 days. You know, so when I thought about that before, I was like, fuck it, we got to do it. Had I known how hard that was, I probably would have like been like, oh, let's change some of this.
Right.
Let's figure this out, you know. So it's hard to say what I would have done differently on that, because I think so much of it came out of trying to stretch and make things happen, make things work, like and a lot of beautiful things. And you learn that from music, too. So I had some confidence in that. Even though all these variables were in play, trying to figure out how we can make this broken amp work, you know, and you figure out a different sound that, wow, this sound, this, now we're basing it around this crazy sound.
Sure.
And this is, you know, like had, you know, a couple decades of experience at that and knowing that magic can come from that. And we had a lot of those moments.
We live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon. A mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time. of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonymorrison.com or wherever books are sold.
On set, so it's hard to say that now I can do things with a bigger budget, but the good thing is that my ideas are always way bigger than anybody would ever give me money for, right? So it probably will always still have that stretching it sort of thing to the process that you know makes cool things come out.
Do you have a top five directors in your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I could say Iñárritu. Emir Kusturica, who's a Serbian filmmaker, made movies that are, to me, influenced me a lot. And again, memory isn't work. Black Cat, White Cat, Underground, Time of Gypsies. Kubrick is definitely, like, the way everything is important. Like, somebody's not just walking down a hall because you got to show that they got to the other room.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Everything that happens in there is important. That's, you know, that's what I intend to do with all of my stuff. It's, you know, the stuff is always... is always changing, so it's hard. You know, I feel weird with the top five question because one, I'm as you see, I'm bad at remembering things, and some of the directors are ones that I know now. So
sure.
If I say here and say their movie, but I forgot their name, it's gonna be weird. And but you know, other folks like Milos Forman and you know, Fireman's Ball and Loves of a Blonde and how he deals with like people and bodies and just kind of on top of each other and humanity, you know, slapped against each other. The way that's shown and felt. I'm doing one of the things I'm writing. I think would probably fall in the realm of science fiction and is very influenced by Sergei Parajanov and like Color of Pomegranates and how the wides are really populated with all of these details, yet there's still a point of reference that your eye is drawn to. There are a lot. I like other things that I think maybe I'm not influenced by, like some of the flamenco films of Carlos Saura, the trilogy he did, where there's Carmen, and then there's my favorite probably El Amor Brujo, and things like that, which kind of feel like a live thing. And there's plenty of like new directors that are trying things that I really like.
I liked Black Klansman, but I struggled with it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And your tweets about it took my visceral struggle with it to a much more articulated intellectual place. And you attacked it in a very intellectual way. With facts. It was not just like, here's my opinion, I'm mad at you, but like, from my factual position, this is very problematic. Why did you want to, I mean, like, you know, you started with loving or respecting Spike and his work. That's the beginning of your film career.
Yeah, and
so
I still do.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I still do. And
still have great respect for Spike.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, even more than even my film career, first demo tape I sent was to 40 Acres and a Mule Music Works.
Wow.
right?
Wow.
And so maybe, you know, maybe I'm a little, no, I'm just kidding. But so it has nothing to do with that, but you know, I'm commenting on all sorts of things. I think I got especially met because I actually went into seeing Black Klansman. Like, if you look at the tweets before I go see it, I did like a whole thread of tweets that were just exalting Spike, right?
Sure.
And I went in to see it and got disgusted. I will say this. Look, one reason I feel comfortable saying these things is because I followed Spike through his whole career, and I know that he'd be saying the same, and he has said this. I mean, what I say is very tame compared to what Spike says about films that he doesn't like.
Sure.
And, you know, and it doesn't matter whether they're white, black, whatever. He says what he thinks.
Sure.
And often what he thinks, you know, he'll say, and he'll sum someone up in a very insulting way. That's just his yeah. thing. So I'm thinking I'm saying something that is not going to be taken, you know, well, since I think I know him from interviews, I'm sure that an artist are going to be insulted. Like, you know, somebody can do a review that's bad of mine, and I won't say that my ego won't be hurt, but, you know, like, that's your first reaction. So that's that being said, I think filmmakers, artists, that's part of art. Like, when I'm making a piece of art, it's a critique.
Sure.
Not only of society, but of other art. It's just implicit in what we're doing.
I mean, this film is the most anti-capitalism film that Hollywood has ever created. So there is a deep critique of capitalism baked into the film.
Yeah. And so, and I'll say this. This will probably be the last thing I say about this film, because I will say that over the course of the reaction to my critique.
Of Black Klansman.
One, there was all these writings of how dare he say anything.
Which that doesn't make any
sense. You know, and matter of fact, writers, journalists saying that. You know, like, you don't get paid to write film critique. That's what one journalist publicly said.
It was not film critique. It was not a film. Yeah. You were not trying to be Roger Ebert.
Yeah. Even if I did, you know, I'm someone out in the world.
Lenses. It was about you are lionizing the police. You are leaving out important parts of the story.
Well, so, and then I ran into, I'm just saying this for the history record. Then I ran into Spike at the governor's ball. Like, he accidentally walked up beside me. I think we both didn't see each other. Then we saw each other. I stuck out my hand to shake his hand. And I started to say, I know you're probably, you know, I probably got three words out. I was going to say, like, something like about these are just my thoughts. This is, you know, how much I respect you and all that kind of stuff. And he did shake my hand, but he let go of it and kept walking. And as he walked, he turned around and said, you know, because I had made a tweet, which just lets me know he was reading my tweets, so it made me kind of feel good. I made a tweet, like, during the thing of saying, you know, like, it was good to have a film out at the same time as Spike. It was like a dream, like, in the theaters at the same time, you know. And I said that was like Miles and Dizzy or whatever, you know, like, going back and forth. And they, you know, and there's something that feels like that. Anyway, so he was like, you made a tweet saying something about Miles and Dizzy. I want to tell you something. And he's backing up as he's saying this, and then he yells out, I'm Miles Davis. You're Chet Baker. and he kept saying that over and over as he walked away.
You're Chet Baker.
Yeah.
You're Chet Baker.
Yeah. and then I saw him again at the DGA thing. And he was like, hey, man, you know, and he grabbed my hand, gave me like the one hand, you know, handshake, hug sort of thing. He was like, squashed? And I was like, yeah, squashed. He was like, cool. And then that was it, you know.
Okay.
So I'm just saying this thing for the record, because all of that stuff has been out and squashed, and so what I'll say is this. It's my one regret about, and this will be the last thing I say about this film. My one regret is, in writing that critique, is that I had written it after I read only half of the memoir.
Okay.
Had I read the whole memoir, my critique would have been way more scathing. Because, and this is about, and here's where I let Spike off the hook to a certain extent, is I believe he probably got the script because it was already written and didn't really research exactly what had happened, right? And from the script that he was handed, he worked with that and apparently added more stuff, but, you know, he worked with that. So, but let me just take it from Ron Stallworth and who he actually was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who is the star, the
character.
Subject of Black
Now,
Kingsman.
Ron Stallworth, he writes this book in which he, at the very first chapter, talks about infiltrating an organization that Stokely Carmichael was connected to in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. In the book, he, at the end, brags. Because now, this book was written on Police and Fire Press. So a press that is meant to go out to other police officers. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. in this, he's bragging to other cops. That's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. In it, he says, I started my career by investigating the Black Panther Party. Now, Colorado Springs, early 70s, Stokely Carmichael, not Black Panther Party, All African People's Revolutionary Party, mm-hmm. right? But he felt that nobody would know who that group was. So he lies on there and says Black Panther Party, just to brag. So this tells you who this person is, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. right away. Like, I'm just, but separately, in 1979, when the events that are supposedly happening with the KKK happen, he was not only taking part in something that had to do with the KKK, he was infiltrating an organization that I later joined called the Progressive Labor Party. And in the book, he states the reason that he was infiltrating that organization was because they had the slogan, Smash the Klan.
Okay.
And they were doing things that were stopping Klan rallies.
Okay.
They were disrupted. They were basically like an Antifa at the time, except without the facial coverings or whatever.
Okay.
And they were actually stopping Klan rallies. Okay. Right? And so he, listen to this, he infiltrated that organization because they were stopping Klan rallies. Mm. So he goes in there, and what he lays out in the book is, at the same time as he's meeting every week with the FBI dude, he infiltrates the POP, finds out how they're going to stop these rallies, tells it to the police, who then tell it to the guy that's in the Klan, and they figure out how to organize their rallies so they don't get stopped.
So
in the movie, it doesn't even say, I mean, he actually doesn't infiltrate the Klan. He makes a phone call.
Right.
So somebody else, so the whole, wow, this is amazing. He makes a phone call. He doesn't, but what he's infiltrating is a radical organization. So he does that separately. There's a part in the movie, and for folks that hadn't read the critique, none of the stuff about a bomb or stopping a bomb ever happened.
Right.
And for folks that are not familiar with the real world, none of that stuff about all the cops coming together to get rid of a racist cop.
That's insane.
Happened.
That's
you know?
Insane. That would never even happen.
So, you know, none of the quote unquote good stuff happened.
thanks to Boots for an amazing interview. And thanks to you for listening. Torre Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and maybe this show can help. I'm on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show. Please leave a review on iTunes. It really helps. And tell your friends about the show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Brandon Tago, and our photographer is Chuck Marcus, and we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back next Wednesday with another amazing person because the man can't shut us down.